Our next case is State v. Thunder. State v. Thunder. You may.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Court, counsel. My name is Matthew Arney. I represent the appellant, Walker Thunder, in this matter. As the court's aware, there are several issues on appeal here. The broad issues, though, can be split up into two categories. Number one is the issue of the search of this RV, and the second issue is the statements that Mr. Thunder made. While we argue he was entitled to his Miranda protections. With regards to the first issue in the case, which is the search, we need to first look at the issue of whether there was valid consent given to search the vehicle. As the court's aware, Mr. Thunder was a passenger in the RV. And consent to search the RV was given by a renter, the person primarily in charge of the RV, Joan Ambler. She authorized a search of the RV. She did not specifically authorize a search of the luggage in the RV. At the time she authorized the search of the RV, I believe it was Deputy Henkel who was the person that started the search. I don't remember if it was Henkel or Brabick. But either way, that deputy was very aware that there was more than one person in the RV. The information that deputy had at the time was that the persons in the RV were not closely related. This was not a familial family situation.
Well, that information came from one of the passengers. And if I read the record correctly, that passenger said he wasn't familiar with the other people. That doesn't necessarily mean that the renter, the lessee of the vehicle, wasn't familiar with them. I understand it's not a familial relationship.
Right. You're not incorrect there, but at the same time, there was no evidence that this Ms. Ambler was familiar with anybody else in the vehicle. The only evidence was that Sylvester Castro, the driver that was initially questioned, didn't really know people in the vehicle. But there was no evidence that the other people in the vehicle knew each other or had any kind of relation.
So you don't contest that the renter of the vehicle could give consent to search it?
To search the RV
search
itself.
The RV.
No, we do not contest
okay.
that. The distinction here is we get into a search of the luggage.
Well, let's talk about that. You lump it all together as luggage. And as I understand, the gun case is distinct from the luggage. Would you agree with that?
But not necessarily. It's a container that carries something in this RV. Certainly,
but the police officer, I believe, testified it was readily identifiable as a gun case.
Yes,
they look
did.
Different than your Samsonite bag.
Yeah, absolutely. But we don't view that as any different than the Samsonite bag or a cardboard box. I understand there's some concerns. A gun case and red flags might go off. A gun, we understand that, but the incriminating nature of a gun case is not inherently obvious because in order for that to be the case, there must be probable cause to associate that item with criminal activity. There must be probable cause to believe that the contents of that case before it's opened will, once you open it up, you're going to find contraband.
What about the evidence that both the driver and the renter said there are no guns in the RV?
Absolutely.
And they were both acting very nervous?
Right.
Do those two facts maybe get you to some probable cause to open that gun case?
I think it would be disingenuous of me to say those don't matter at all, but I think they do. To answer your question, no, they do not get us to probable cause. I would not necessarily argue that maybe they get us to reasonable suspicion, but again, to ignore those would be disingenuous, but I don't think you get to probable cause. Again, as Mr. Castro said, he didn't really know the people that well, so there's no expectation that he would have knowledge of what is in everyone else's belongings.
Where exactly was the gun case?
The gun case, to my recollection, the deputy couldn't recall if it was underneath some other baggage or just kind of sitting out in the open. I don't recall exactly what the record shows on that particular matter. I don't believe that he had to open any cabinets or drawers. I don't believe he did to find the gun case. I think it was just underneath some stuff or sitting on a shelf. I believe it.
And then describe the gun case. Did it have some wording on it?
There was nothing elicited on the record about that to my recollection. My recollection is just that Deputy Hinkle testified it was readily identifiable or obviously a gun case. There was no mention of a brand being imprinted or formed into the plastic case or sticker on it identifying a particular brand of firearm inside.
And there's no evidence the officer knew whose gun case it was when he opened it.
That's correct. That's exactly correct. And the ownership of any guns did not come up until, I believe, after the second gun was found, which was found also in Mr. Thunder's duffel bag later on. And then after the deputy came out of the vehicle, he asked who these were, and we get into, later on we'll get into statements or the issue of Mr. Thunder's statements to the deputy at that point.
But does it matter that Mr. Thunder or any of the other passengers did not protest or did not say, no, you can't search?
That's a very relevant question. I think in this particular case, the answer is no, it does not matter. Specifically, Mr. Thunder, looking at a couple of the cases mentioned in the briefs, you have, I believe, the Elam case is one, and the other one is missing at the moment. But our case is more readily an analogy to know this case. Our office handled this case, the DiGiorgio case from the federal court. In that case, the passenger, I believe Christopher DiGiorgio, was told by the law enforcement officer that his brother, the driver, had consented to a search of the vehicle. And Christopher, happened to be our client, did not say, no, you can't search my stuff, did not ask for differentiation between his luggage or his brother's. And the court held that search was invalid. So in this case, our case, Mr. Thunder's case, is analogous to the DiGiorgio case, where even if Mr. Thunder heard the statement by law enforcement that Ms. Ambler had said we can search the RV, he did not have an affirmative obligation to say, well, you can't search my stuff. The difference is in the Elam case that's mentioned in the briefs. In that case, the law enforcement officer started to search items in front of the tenant and a landlord, but the officer had a reasonable belief at that point that the tenant who consented to search had authority over, I think it was a safe that ended up being searched that belonged to the landlord. The landlord didn't say anything about it, but the officer had reasonable belief to believe the tenant could consent. In this case, there's no reasonable belief suggests that Ms. Ambler had common authority over anyone's baggage other than her own.
But we don't know it's not hers.
Exactly, but it's very clear that there's more than one person in this vehicle. The only evidence is that there's not a strong relationship between these people coming from Mr. Castro. And it's very reasonable for the deputy to ask, well, whose luggage is whose? That's the threshold question here. Is there a reasonable basis for this deputy to believe that Ms. Ambler had common authority over the rest of, or over all the luggage in there? Kind of like this isn't quite a Greyhound bus where you got 47 people on there and one person can't consent to a search of everyone else's bags, but this isn't the family on vacation where the father can consent to a search of the minor child's luggage. That's the threshold question. Was it reasonable for the deputy to believe Ms. Ambler had common authority over this other baggage of other people, and there's no basis to believe that.
You go ahead.
Does the consent to search differ if you're talking about an automobile versus a house?
Well, I think it does, because the house is, the castle, that's the most private area that you're going to find. An automobile, there's a little bit lesser expectation of privacy, I believe. But in this case, it's the luggage that's searched, and there's a differentiation in the context, and I think there's even a difference between automobile and an RV, just because of the nature of the RV. It gets closer. Some people live in RVs. It has an element of home to it. So in this case, it wasn't a house, but it's an RV, I think, is between a vehicle and a regular vehicle.
case from the federal court from the Eighth Circuit, similar. You know, I read Banks, and I think it's somewhat applicable here.
I think Banks, if you read in the appellee mentioned, or quoted a long section of Banks in their brief, but if you read further in Banks, like in fact right after their language stopped, Banks starts to back off of this single purpose doctrine, and they recognize now we start applying the single purpose doctrine in a way that the appellee would have it applied any container can be packaged as cigarettes, for example. There'd be no expectation of privacy in that. The appellant argues that that just doesn't terrific amount of time, so I'll yield to the appellee.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Morning, Mr. Liss.
Good morning, morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Nate Liss, appearing on behalf of the athlete of the State of Nebraska. As far as the guns found inside the RV, the facts are not in dispute. The positive question here, which is a question of law, is whether the gun found in the gun case should have been suppressed. That gun is the only one that matters because that gun alone was sufficient for both convictions here. The State maintains that that gun was properly admitted at trial because even if it, for the sake of argument, was unlawfully obtained, the inevitable discovery doctrine would apply here. As set forth in our brief, the law is well established that under the inevitable discovery doctrine, even if evidence has been unlawfully obtained, it's nonetheless admissible if it would have been discovered without reference to the police misconduct in question. And the applicable standard here is preponderance of the evidence.
How would it have otherwise been discoverable? How the application of that doctrine, under what circumstances would the officers otherwise have discovered it?
Well, the record reflects that Deputy Hankel was clearly concerned about whether or not there were guns in the RV, given that he asked both Castro and Ambler whether there were guns in the vehicle before he searched it. He was clearly concerned once he saw the gun case, given that they had both told him there were no guns in the RV. He testified that it was definitely obvious it was a gun case, so he was clearly going to investigate the contents of that case. And I would submit that perhaps most importantly here, Thunder himself admitted that the gun in the gun case was his, despite the fact that there was no pressure or incentive to do so, and he wasn't even personally questioned about the contents of the gun case. He simply volunteered that information upon Deputy Hankel asking whose guns were in the RV. So we would submit that based on all of that evidence, all of which is undisputed, the officers, there is a reasonable probability that even if they hadn't initially opened that gun case, they would have inquired about the contents of the gun case, learned that it was Thunder's, and would have inevitably been discovered anyway, but for the alleged police misconduct.
So if the officer, instead of opening the gun case during his search, had taken it outside and said, whose gun case is this, you think inevitably it would have been discovered to be Thunder's?
Yes, that's our position. It seems to me that that would have unfolded, or the outcome that would have unfolded would have been just the same if that had happened, especially, like I said, in light of the fact that Mr. Thunder himself just freely volunteered that information upon being asked. And as I recall the record, I don't want to be wrong on it, but I don't recall him even being confronted with the guns. Deputy Hankel just went out and said, whose guns are in the vehicle? He said mine.
What is your recollection as to what the testimony was as to where the gun case was located inside of it?
My recollection is the same as Mr. Arnie's. I don't think the record was crystal clear on that anyway, but I think the officer testified that, as he recalled, it was just amongst the luggage. He didn't have to open any luggage, didn't have to open anything to see the gun case, but he didn't recall exactly where it was amongst the luggage. It was just
Is it your position that was in plain view once he entered the RV?
Yes, I believe that the gun case would be in plain view inside the RV.
And that it was a distinctive gun case?
Yes. I mean, I think that's, at least based on his testimony, that would be undisputed. The district court made a finding to that effect, and I don't think that's clearly erroneous. I wasn't going to go into consent or probable cause. We can certainly go into that if the court has questions, but I guess in our view, even for the sake of argument, if we had some problem with consent or probable cause, the inevitable discovery doctrine would apply, so I was going to leave it at that.
Let's talk about when, and I understand, and I agree it's bothersome, that when both the renter and the driver say there's no guns or drugs on the RV, and then he goes in and he sees a gun case in plain view, does he have probable cause to think that there is criminal activity at that point when he doesn't know anything further?
Well, that's the difficult part, Your Honor, and that's kind of why I'm stopping short here. in order for probable cause to be present, a reasonable person would have to believe that a crime has been committed or is being committed, and possession of a gun alone is not a crime. So unlike some of the cases I've pointed to, there's no evidence in this case that the officer knew or had reason to believe anybody here was a felon or could not otherwise lawfully possess a gun, which makes it a bit difficult to say that alone provides probable cause. Having said that, I'm going to stop short of conceding it. District Court found that probable cause was present here, and I'm not sure that that's necessarily wrong, but I will acknowledge that I think it's...
Is it a concealed weapon?
Well, that would certainly contradict it being in plain view, which we're relying on. So I think it'd be a bit disingenuous of me to claim that it is a concealed weapon. I looked at that as I was briefing it, and I'm not sure that I could represent that that was a concealed weapon. So not in light of the test. I believe the record undisputedly establishes that it was in plain view. So I don't know. If there are no...
Let me just ask you, if it was a, and this is probably obvious, if it was an unlawful search, then everything after that, including the statements and that, would have to come out, would they not?
That would depend on whether statements are sufficiently attenuated from the unlawful search or seizure in question. You can have sufficient attenuation, for instance, if something happens and enough time passes and the person is clearly advised of rights and nonetheless confess. I mean, a confession could still be in. But if we, for the sake of argument, if the gun were out, I don't know how we'd have a conviction.
Because then there's really nothing else. I mean, it was the fact that he was a felon that they determined afterwards, right?
It would, yeah, I mean, I think the whole house cards in this case falls if the gun is suppressed, Your Honor.
All right.
Briefly, as far as the second issue, the admissibility of the pre-Miranda statements, we would submit that the admission of those statements was proper and they did not run afoul of Miranda because Thunder was not in custody when he made the statements, nor was the product of an interrogation. As far as whether he was in custody, as set forth in our brief, was well established that in the context of traffic stops, the person is not in custody for purposes of Miranda unless the circumstances rise to the level of an arrest. That wasn't the case here when he made these pre-Miranda statements. They also weren't obtained during interrogation. Law is well settled that when asking routine questions such as these, it doesn't amount to an interrogation for purposes of Miranda. So we would submit that neither component of Miranda was implicated or violated in this case with respect to the statements. There are no further questions.
Anything further? Okay, thank you.
We would ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time do we have left for rebuttal? All right. Thank you both for being here. The case is under advisement. Thank you. See you in a bit.